Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This podcast is a joint presentation of the Colorado Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. This month, we include a discussion of serotonin syndrome with Dr. Lee Annenberg, followed by Dr. Bruce Smith and Dr. Gregory Gom revisiting the use of statins in seniors.
Okay, I want to start off with two case examples, and then I'll go through some of the mechanisms and just highlight things to be thinking about with this. The first was a medical malpractice case that didn't have anything to do with the nursing home, but it was a lady in her 60s who lived in the community and was taking 60 milligrams a day of Prozac. She developed a mass in her neck and went in, and it was determined to probably be a parathyroid adenoma, but the surgeon injected methylene blue during the surgery, which causes a flush in parathyroid tissue. Well, what the surgeon didn't know was, first, he didn't even know she was on Prozac, but this lady ended up in the ICU for 2 weeks and was eventually diagnosed with serotonin syndrome, severe enough she had to be intubated and almost died. That case ended up being settled because there wasn't any defense that he didn't know what the drug was, what Prozac did, and that it was a risk for serotonin syndrome. The second case involved, it's in this article that we passed around, so since this is a national distribution now, Psychiatric Advisor in April 16th, 2019 had an article called Detecting and Managing Serotonin Syndrome. In the midst of the article, it describes an event where Dr. Campbell Taylor recounted the case of a patient who was being treated with an SSRI and taking over-the-counter melatonin for insomnia. He woke up during the night with headache, dizziness, and his face on fire, quote unquote, which is typically a sign of elevated blood pressure. The fact that it wasn't lethal is likely because he took a relatively small amount of melatonin and his symptoms abated without requiring hospitalization. Now, I've never thought of melatonin as being a risk drug for this, and I'm not actually sure it is, but I thought I'd mention that got mentioned in this article. So what are the risks of serotonin syndrome? What is it? There are a variety of ways that these drugs impair metabolism of serotonin. So I want to just go briefly through some of the mechanisms of how that occurs. And then we'll talk about what the risky drugs are and the signs and symptoms. So mechanisms of serotonin syndrome, you can inhibit the uptake of serotonin, and we know of lots of drugs that do that. That's essentially how SSRIs, reuptake inhibitors, work. And there's a list in the accompanying articles. The second mechanism is inhibition of serotonin metabolism. And there's one of the familiar drugs is Buspar for that, Buspirone. Another inhibition of metabolism was the methylene blue that I mentioned in the example from a surgeon. Monoamine oxidase inhibitors, triptans, migraine medicines fit into that category. There's a class of drugs that increase serotonin synthesis, and amphetamines are in that, L-tryptophan, again, dietary supplements in that, cocaine is in that group. Increase in serotonin release, again, lots of drugs that do that. Activating serotonin receptors, buspirone is again in that category, along with some of the antidepressants and the ergots and the triptan drugs, and some narcotics. Fentanyl is on that list. Then we get into the CYP450 metabolism. You have the 2D6 inhibitors. That includes fluoxetine and sertraline. The D26, 2D6 substrates, dextromethorphan, oxycodone, phentermine, risperidone, tramadol starts showing up on some of these things. Then the 2C19 inhibitors and 2C19 substrates includes citalopram. There's additional drugs and supplements that are associated with serotonin syndrome, and all of these are referenced with specific articles. We've talked about migraine medicines, but also proton pump inhibitors, even ACE inhibitors. Benazepril, lisinopril, enalapril, captopril have been from time to time associated. There's even cardioselective beta adrenergic blocking drugs, atenolol, esmolol, bisoprolol, digitalis, antibiotic linezolid, rivaroxaban is in the category that has been associated with it. So now, so you can see that the list is quite long, so you have to have awareness of the drugs that are being given. But how will you get the call from the nursing home? What will it sound like? Well, you're going to hear that someone has agitation, that they're restless, they may have akathisia, that they have ataxia or unsteady on their feet. Or the nurses may not recognize, but if they do, that they have clonus, confusion, diaphoresis, which is actually excessive sweating, diarrhea, disseminated intravascular coagulation, fever, hyperreflexia, hypertension, muscle rigidity, multi-organ failure, mydriasis, that's change in the eyes, rhabdomyolysis, shivering, seizures, tachycardia, and tremors. So not real specific. None of those by themselves would make us think directly of this. So got to know what the Hunter serotonin toxicity criteria are. And they go through things like spontaneous clonus, whether it's inducible clonus, and that's usually easiest to do at the ankle. Or they have inducible clonus with either agitation or diaphoresis, excessive sweating. Or they have ocular clonus. And so on YouTube, you can see pictures of where their eyelids are spasming. That's ocular clonus. It's not the eyeball itself moving, but it's the eyelids going in spasm. Tremor and hyperreflexia, or even high fever, ocular clonus, and increased muscle tension or hypertonia. So there's a whole long list of those things on the serotonin selection criteria. So I mentioned this briefly with Dr. Watson, and she says she thinks it's probably overdiagnosed. And I'm sitting there more in my role as a geriatrician thinking that maybe it's underdiagnosed. So I don't truthfully know, but SSRIs as a class, so the number 10 cause of fatal drug reactions in the US, out of the top 25, it's number 10 as a category. So I think there is ample opportunity for it. And I'll finish up by just saying that there's another nice review a few years back in the American Family Physician. I'll forward this as well. It's put out by the AAFP called Prevention, Diagnosis, and Management of Serotonin Syndrome, and it has some tables. It has a more concise version of the signs and symptoms of serotonin syndrome, and it has this Hunter's decision rules for diagnosis of serotonin toxicity. So I'll pass that along as well, and that gives probably a more concise way of looking at this. Now, with the differential diagnosis, you can have malignant hyperthermia. There's some drugs that cause people to go out and not be able to regulate their temperature and get body temperatures above 108. There's neuroleptic malignant syndrome with hypertension, tachycardia, tachypnea, and high fever as high as 105.8. And then anticholinergic syndrome with tachycardia, tachypnea, and hyperthermia. And so a lot of this is like Venn diagrams that all sort of overlap. And this is more nicely laid out in this American Family Physician article. So I'll share that. So be aware and look at the med list carefully when you get a call about someone being agitated and you're being tempted through this phone call to add another drug. I always would challenge you to think about withdrawing a drug, do judicious deprescribing instead of adding to prescription cascade of another drug. So that's the end of my talk. Are there any questions?
Lee, I have one comment and then maybe two comments. One, since we have a wider audience, Dr. Watson, for those who don't know, is a geropsychiatrist that we prominently use in this community. And the other thing is I find that this almost parallels what we do with anticholinergic medications. We talk about them, recognize how important things like the Magellan Risk Scale are and in anticholinergics and trying to get rid of them, you know, how important that is. And then when it gets down to day-to-day practice, we forget about it and just don't do it until somebody else is looking at it. So I don't know how to raise the level of awareness day-to-day.
Well, I think teaching nurses how to recognize Clonus and how to induce Clonus, you know, easiest at the ankle with a rapid dorsiflexion of the ankle, and then it sets up beating Clonus. So you can demonstrate that to the patients out on rounds, find a cooperative patient and ask them if you could demonstrate it to the nurses of how to test for it. And then again, how to check for tone in the muscles and how to look carefully at the eyes and is there a sign of ocular Clonus. So I think teaching of the nursing staff is a place to start.
Right. Yes, an excellent presentation, Dr. Annenberg. Fascinating, especially as medical directors when we're reviewing residents who are elderly and have chronic issues. One issue that this certainly helps us understand, I think, is when elderly are placed on loperamide, Imodium, for loose stool, and they may have this for weeks or sometimes months, and you've done a workup, an infectious workup, you've done a workup for pancreatic insufficiency, for malabsorption, for biliary salt issues, on and on and on. Everything's negative, and you know, we should also take a look at the medications. It might be that an SSRI is combined with an SNRI or high dose of an SSRI or one of a complication of medications that you so well reviewed for us in your presentation. What are your thoughts?
Well, real quickly, because we're due to go on to the second talk, but Zoloft, in my experience, stimulates the GI tract the most of any of the SSRIs. If someone's a one day a person with a bowel movement, they become a 2 to 3 per time a day. If they're 2 or 3 time a day, they go to 4 to 6 times a day. It's most often when they first start it, but it can occur any time. Same is true, of course, with things like metformin. Very commonly provokes loose stools. So drugs certainly can be the cause of that, even without serotonin syndrome.
Thank you, Dr. Annenberg. Then we're going to move on to Dr. Bruce Smith, the medical director for Optum.
So Bruce and I are going to sort of do this together. In part, Bruce did a wonderful presentation here about 2 years ago just on statins in seniors. And then in a recent edition of JAMA, there was a wonderful perspective written by Neil Skolnick from Jefferson College. Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. And what I really liked about this article and why we're going to look at it, it meets all the criteria for our audience. It's really short, so a lot of people might actually read it. And then the second, it's really packed with a summary of a lot of information that I think that meets the basic criteria for what we're trying to do with this journal club, which is what can I take away today and put into my practice. So as we start this out, and just so that Bruce knows too, I'm going to go over most of the first page of this, which is a review of why we would or wouldn't use statins or cholesterol drugs in our population. And then I'm going to let Bruce talk more about when we would take it away and how and why and how we do that. So at any rate, to start this out, he starts out by talking about ACC and AHA guidelines on management of blood cholesterol. Their recommendation is, quote, in adults 75 years of age or older with an LDL of 70 to 189, initiating moderate intensity statin may be reasonable, which is an odd way to state it, and the article does talk about how we state recommendations. If that recommendation were interpreted by the average provider out there reading it to mean that everybody that meets those criteria should be on a statin, we would have about 18 million older adults on statins in the United States alone, putting them at risk for adverse effects and perhaps no benefit. So, according to the introduction to the primary prevention section of the guideline, patients over age 75, RCT evidence for statin therapy is not strong. They go on later, talk about the tables and the guidelines that show that there's limited evidence supporting primary prevention in adults over 75 and no evidence supporting a low density lipoprotein cholesterol cutoff greater than 70. In 8 primary prevention trials, in folks without diabetes, the average entry LDL was 140, which is about twice as high as the 70 mentioned in the article. The proportional benefit of managing high cholesterol is greater for adults under 65 than over 65, and there's another difference between age 65 and age 75 as far as benefit goes. In clinical data demonstrating benefits of statins for primary prevention are just not available for adults over age 75. And even if that's the only thing you take away from my part of this presentation, it's just that in folks over age 75, there is no data. It's sort of like what we recently discussed with aspirin, and the fact that for primary prevention, at least with aspirin, there is more risk than benefit. In this population, and here at least with statins, there's no data. In the PROSPER trial, which is the only trial of statin treatment for patients older than 75, the average LDL on entry was 147, which is, again, that's the average, and that's way outside the range of what the guidelines are trying to direct you to. Of the 5,800 patients in that study, about half, 2,565, had vascular disease, so they were there for secondary prevention. In the primary prevention group, those without vascular disease, there was no significant benefit of statins on the endpoints of coronary death, myocardial infarctions, or fatal or non-fatal strokes. So again, sort of echoes the idea that secondary prevention, okay, primary prevention, just no data or no evidence of benefit here, at least where they did look at it. There's no mortality benefit of statin treatment for individuals over age 75, and there is plenty of evidence of harms, including increased mortality. Bruce. For now, we'll have questions, I'm sure, at the end. But if it's all right, I'm going to let you talk about now that we've talked
sure.
about factors, very little benefit, what do we do next?
Sure, yeah. I'd like to say that I think this article really dovetails nicely with Dr. Levy's presentation that she gave to CMDA in February. CMDA.us, that presentation that she gave was fantastic and thorough, and it's still available to look at. So if you want more information, she has a great presentation, and this really dovetails nicely with it. So I agree. I mean, the first part of this article really talks about the lack of evidence for primary prevention in older individuals. And then it calls for a discussion and guidance on, well, how do we stop them? We were talking about how do we start them and in whom do we start them, but how do we stop them? And it talks about a couple of different groups that we should consider. First of all, the category of very frail older patients, many of whom are living in nursing homes, many of whom have advanced illnesses or severe dementia. Do they really benefit from this? Probably not, either in primary or secondary prevention. You know, the next category of patients it speaks to is, okay, those that actually do have cardiovascular disease, the secondary prevention. There is data behind secondary prevention, but we should probably be looking at the goals of care on that patient, okay? Same with diabetic patients. There actually is data on treating diabetic patients with statins, even into advanced age, but still, we need the prescribing of statins to be consistent with what their goals of care are. And then lastly, what this entire article was about was primary prevention. In that subgroup, we really need to think and be thoughtful about whether we start them in those patients. Now, you know, when there's a lack of evidence, medicine is so complex now that we're often looking for a guideline or an algorithm to just make it easy, right? Let's just make this clear and go on our way. But when there's a lack of evidence on something, we really have to bring, I think, the art of medicine back into it, and you really need to individualize your decisions. And so the second part of this article really talks about the need to do that. There's more of a movement to individualize treatment. If anybody is familiar with the most recent ADA guidelines on diabetes treatment, it speaks a lot to that patient-centered approach. And the end of this article really calls out the need to do that individually with our older patients, just because there is a lack of data right now. Of note, getting back to Dr. Levy's presentation that's on the CMDA website, there's also a thorough review in the appendix of that presentation on the side effects of statins, which I encourage people to look at, because it actually has some hard data as opposed to kind of conjecture on what the side effects of statins may be. Again, in summary, we talked about when to initiate statins. We should also talk about when to get rid of statins in our population.
Could I ask, is there any literature to suggest that you have to taper a statin when you're discontinuing it?
I have not seen any of that. I think you can just stop it. And I have a pharmacist here shaking her head yes. So I feel better.
Thank you.
If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.